Hey friends, we're glad you joined us. Jeff here. I'm going to be joined by Stacy and Sydney in a little bit, but first I want to just kind of set up our conversation. And our conversation is about what's called Inner Alchemy. It's a show about alchemy in general, in the sense that everything we take into our lives, chemicals, relationships, social situations, all of these things are the stuff of our existence, and we've got to make something out of it. And we see in this idea, symbolically, in alchemy, a way of transmuting, as they would say it, or transforming the stuff of our lives into something that's powerful, something that's life-giving. Now, if you find yourself listening to this today, maybe this is a great time for you to be thinking about this in your own life, applying it to your own life, both in terms of how you view medicine and religion, but also in the ways in which, however you feel about the world, you can do something different, that there's another world possible that starts with you. So let's get into it. What's alchemy? Alchemy is an occult or esoteric science thought to hold the secrets of transmuting lower metals into gold, or using minerals or distillations to create a universal elixir of life. And this goes both for the Western tradition that comes out of medieval Christianity, but thinks that it's at least drawing from something more ancient in the Eastern traditions. For them, that would be what we would call the Middle East or Near East, and Egypt, and of course the Greeks. But in the East, in China, you have elixirs of life also that are there. In fact, it's probably more of a thing in Chinese traditions. But in both cases, they thought that there was somehow a way of using the elements of the world to produce something that would prolong life, help trees grow better, you know, give women better fertility, these sorts of things. So there's an element of using the elements for money, like gold, and then there's also the stuff that is the energies of life. Let's start with the Chinese alchemy. Chinese alchemy focused on creating an elixir of life or the drug of deathlessness, but it typically used toxic substances like mercury and arsenic. Although it was common knowledge that alchemists could create deadly poisons, and people knew this, people saw and met and heard about people that were emperors and state officials who had died from drinking the elixirs that Taoist charlatans really were concocting. And this is a long, long tradition. So the founder of the Xin dynasty, Xin Shi Huang, died in 210 BCE. All the way back then, this guy thought he was going to get something powerful, and it ended up killing him. This continued, and throughout different dynasties, during the Tang dynasty, we think maybe five or more emperors died, and it continued until 1735, when Taoist priests were evicted from the imperial palace after Yang Zheng, the emperor, died from overdosing on the elixir. So this puzzle, the puzzle of why people would keep doing this, is even stranger when we consider that a couple father-son emperor pairings died from alchemical poisoning. So you might have a son who goes in and roots out all the alchemists, imprisons them, those who failed his father, and then, instead of just giving up on the whole idea, turns to a whole new group of better alchemists to make the elixir right, you know, to do it in a way that was going to give him life. And then, of course, that son would also die from the poison. This is interesting to me because it says something about the way we view failed religious and magical and medical experiments. Very often, let's just look at the religious side, we find ourselves in a bad, unhealthy religious context. And so we say, all right, I'm gonna leave this. But instead of thinking that you're gonna, you know, reconfigure the way you think about religion in general, you just pick another religion that has a different set of stories and a different set of law codes, only to find that there might be problems for you there. Right? You're just going back to a different version. This was something true for Stacey and I, where we would, you know, feel really liberated from fundamentalist evangelicalism by going into fundamentalist Lutheranism and not realizing that we just kind of exchanged one fundamentalism for another. But this isn't just true for religion. You know, you've got people in conspiracy theory land who will be disappointed by one odd online conspiracy, but only for a moment being disillusioned, they then move into some other type of weird idea. Okay, so that's the Eastern side of things. Basically, all you got to remember is that the Chinese emperors kept dying from these elixirs of life. But there's another story that I think is really fascinating, and I think it would make a great movie. It's about this woman named Anna Maria Zeiglerin. Now, I'm going to just note here for a second, there's a brief mention of sexual assault, so if that's something you don't want to be listening to, maybe skip forward 10 minutes. But she lived from 1550 to 75, so she was a young woman at the end of her life, and there's an odd route towards that end, and it was not a pleasant end. But in any case, Anna Maria, we'll just call her Anna, was a woman alchemist, and that alone makes her kind of interesting, but there were others. It seems that the problem is, as far as historians of this thing have to wrestle with it, there were many women alchemists. The problem is they didn't spend a lot of their time writing stuff out. So the stuff that we tend to get, you know, and look back to is the stuff that was written down by people that had a little bit more of a privileged position. They might have more literacy, and people were paying attention to what they were writing. But what's interesting about Anna is that she did write down a 20-page pamphlet that really spells out, with kind of a recipe-type precision, the ways in which you might be able to come up with that famous thing called the Philosopher's Stone. Now, when she was a young teenager, Anna was forced, or at least her mom tried to force her to marry this guy, Nikolaus von Hamdorf, and she said, no, I don't like this guy. But offended by this unwillingness, Hamdorf assaulted her, and then she got pregnant. She was 14 years old. And so then after giving birth in secret, she wrapped her baby in a linen cloth and drowned it. So this is the start of her, you know, formative existing years. And it was only a couple years later, at the age of 16, that she did end up getting married to a nobleman from Rothenburg. But I suppose fortunately for her, because it didn't seem like she was a big fan of this guy either, he died 9 weeks later in a horse riding accident. Well, then, of course, she was a young widow, so that might have given her a certain kind of freedom. Maybe not economic freedom, depending on how she had her finances. But her brother was alive, and then her brother forced her to marry his pal, a court jester in Gotha named Heinrich Schombach. So now she's married to this jester, and was not happy with this relationship either. In any case, though, when they get to the city of Gotha, where they were living, it was ultimately besieged in 1567. So Anna fled with her jester husband and this other guy who was an alchemist named Philip Sommering. Sommering started working in the court of Duke Julius of Braunschweig-Wolfenbüttel. And this guy, Sommering, was an alchemist. So Anna Maria and her husband became assistants to this guy, Sommering, and their task in the court of Duke Julius was to create a philosopher's stone, which was believed by very intelligent people, movers and shakers, to be able to create gold and gemstones, among other things. The philosopher's stone was thought to be a red stone or a powder that not only had the ability to make these material changes, but could cure diseases and create the elixir of life. Anna said she got this knowledge when she was talking with Duke Julius on her own and not from these other guys she was hanging out with. She said she got it from Count Karl von Oettingen. Now, Count Karl von Oettingen was said to be the son of the famed and cutting-edge alchemist Paracelsus. Problem is, Count Karl did not exist. So it seems like Anna was trying to gain a certain kind of credibility by saying she had an alchemical pedigree and that this alchemical pedigree was something that set her apart from these other guys and also made her invaluable to Duke Julius. Because now, if Duke Julius wanted the gold, well, Duke Julius needed her. So, to show that she really knew what she was talking about, she wrote down her recipes, and these were recipes for using something that she called the lion's blood. It was a golden oil, and she describes how to make it in this booklet, and it's called Concerning the Noble and Precious Art of Alchemia. And in this, what's kind of interesting about this, because I've had other texts, I had a really old copy of Agrippa's Occult Sciences in three volumes, and it's so hard to really make anything out of it that it's fun to have, but it's not like a recipe book that you can, you know, kind of use for your witchery in your living room, you know, very easily. But not so with this particular pamphlet. Now, there were some things that she left out, so you couldn't use it without her, but it showed that there was really some kind of activity there. And when she talks about it, she talks about it in the past tense as if these were experiments that she'd actually run with Count Carl and that these experiments turned out to be successful. So she says, to make lion's blood, you have to start by preparing the gold by projecting a brown powder onto lead. And then this produces a gold when it's cooled. And then she says she filed this into small pieces and then heated it again for more than 9 hours. And she does a bunch of other stuff. But then skipping forward, she then says she produces a flesh-colored mist that was the golden lion, and that this would exude luminous, lovely blood that could then be captured and condensed. And so this was her lion's blood oil. And she used this to create the Philosopher's Stone. But then it gets a little bit sad for those of us who love little creatures, because she said the alchemist should then take a little bird, a little baby bird, and feed it nothing but drops of this elixir for 6 weeks. Of course, after this, the bird's not going to live, and so then the bird dies, and then the alchemist roasts the bird until it becomes like, quote, brown glass. Then she would shatter and pulverize it with a mortar and pestle, and so much for the baby bird, but that's now this magical potion. And if you didn't like that, she did have another method, a little bit less bizarre, though it was complicated. And that was just simply cleansing mercury with vinegar and salt. That does the trick for mercury. No, it does not. Friends, do not ingest mercury. But you have to do this on a very specific time of the year, and that is a beautiful day in May. Now, once you got your stone, you weren't done. You would fashion it into some cool animal shape. But if you wanted to use it to make gold, you had to soak it in the blood of a suckling lamb for 9 weeks. All right, now you're good. But this could be used to encourage the growth of trees, to cure leprosy, to promote the fertility in women. And if you're at all rooting for her because she's kind of an outlaw and she's doing something witchy and fun, it gets a little uncomfortable when it turns out that then she says to everybody that you could use this, this lion's blood oil, to raise a child for 12 years without any other food or drink. So I don't have any knowledge that this was actually done, but that seems pretty, you know, reckless to say that you could use this to feed babies. So then Anna, Sommering, and Schombach were asked to pay $2,000 by Duke Julius. Now, it's interesting, a taler is a coin that had a stick with a snake on it. And so our dollar sign today, if you notice, is like a stick with a snake on it. That's because it's throwback to this unit, this taller, that had that on it. And it's interesting because, of course, it comes from the Nehushtan, the bronze serpent of the Hebrew Bible, where Moses holds up this serpent on a pole. And in a very alchemical kind of way, he cures these people from their diseases. So there is this kind of alchemy-type thinking in the Hebrew Bible and other places, and it's definitely not a new concept for human culture. Nonetheless, you know what's not new? Charlatans, fraudsters, people that want to use quackery, pseudoscience, and spiritual magic to pull one over on people, and that's what they did. So the Duke said, you know, you owe us $2,000. You're failed at this. And as they started to get a little bit nervous about being found out, Sommering skips town. This makes the other two look guilty. They put a warrant out for all their arrests. The two are arrested first, eventually. I think they're all captured. Yeah, they're all captured. And they were charged with multiple crimes. It seems that maybe they were not charged with their actual crime because probably the Duke didn't want to be looking like a fool to the rest of the folks, but they were charged with attempting to poison a duchess, and they were tortured and eventually confessed. Sommering and Schombach were burned with hot tongs, and they were drawn and quartered. Anna was skinned, and then she was burned alive while strapped to an iron stool. So, again, did not end well, this alchemy. Again, why do we care about this, friends? Well, it's an interesting story, but the first reason we care about it is because in both Western and Eastern alchemical traditions, folks had to eventually come to terms with the fact that you can't take the tradition literally. There might be something really cool and interesting, even for us today at this point in the trajectory of human science. It still can be interesting to look at what alchemy was about and the role it played. But you can't take it literally if you want to survive. If you take it literally, you will literally die. Now that's in alchemy, but I think it's true for religion and ideas. If you don't detach yourself a bit from them on occasion and become circumspect, look around you and see, you know, whether or not you're so deep into some way of thinking that you're not really thinking smart about common sense in the natural world. In the West, people started turning to symbolic and allegorical interpretations of transmutation, and I think this is a good thing. Instead of trying to make something with these chemicals, the point was to do this within ourselves, to kind of deify ourselves, to be able to find our higher nature. But whatever material we start with, in that way of thinking, we could transcend it and see it from a kind of holy perspective, as it were. And so that's kind of cool. But likewise, after all the failed elixirs of the what we call outer alchemy or Weidan of the Taoist traditions, which was based on the historically doubtful claim that Lao Tzu himself created the elixir of life with a friend. But anyway, after all of that failure, the smarter sages started exploring this concept of Nidan, or inner alchemy. And this spoke of the body as a cauldron in which one could brew up, symbolically, but not so symbolically as in the West, I should say. It's kind of these energies really being within you. Think kind of like Tai Chi, where you're kind of imagining this chi, this ball of energy, but it's also something that could be seen as having some kind of reality. In any case, the potion that you would concoct would be using these three treasures called Jing, or life essence, Qi, or vital energy that results from the interaction of yin and yang, and then Shen, spirit or mind. But whatever your way of thinking about the human self or the human consciousness might be, you know, you run across this idea of mind, body, and spirit, that sort of thing. A second reason why we want to discuss all this is also, though, to say that once you get the inner alchemical work done, that is when you're doing that kind of spiritual work, you can then have a little bit more of a healthy perspective when you're approaching what we might call outer alchemy, if by that we mean substances like nicotine, caffeine, alcohol, psychedelics, cannabis. There are ways in which some of those can hold promise for some, especially for folks who are suffering from severe depression. Oregon is going to be opening up operations shortly where people can go and get psychedelic therapy. And we're glad when the drug war starts to disintegrate. And we know that there are people that have been really helped by this. But it's also important to know that you have to approach it from a strong place. And it's also important to consider that maybe, even though alcohol is generally not the best thing to be using, sometimes there might be a time when, you know, it's the the right thing for you. So the inner alchemy we want to explore is also about navigating those other things that might be helpful or addictive in our lives. And by kind of getting that straight, we can live better and more balanced lives. But more importantly, I think we'll be able to find that spiritual freedom from which we gain a kind of mastery, well, if not a mastery, a little bit of an ability to outfox religious wolves, charlatans, and people that want to control us economically and politically. So as you sit back and join me with Stacy and Sydney, and we riff on this idea of inner alchemy, remember, our advice is about the general plan of attack. It is not for a specific formula for your own elixir, metaphorical or real. It's really just our invitation to contemplate with us ways for us to balance our minds and bodies and the things that we take into our bodies. Before we get started with the conversation with Stacy and Sydney, I do want to announce that on May 26th, we have just started to plan for an opportunity to have Micah Bornay, our friend from Long Beach, who's been doing some great hip-hop about toxic masculinity. But of course, also Micah has been on our show, and he is a fantastic poet. And so he's going to be coming and sharing some of his work at our home in North Portland on May 26th. So reach out to us if you're in the area and you want to join us. It might be a great time just to kind of hang out and hear from Micah and probably a couple other artists. And I think you'll have a lot of fun. All right, enough of that. Friends, thanks for being with us. This has been a little pedantic, perhaps, but it will not be pedantic right after the music. Right, right.
All ahead full.
All right, kiddos, it's been a crazy fun week. Good to be able to sit here and think about this stuff.
Yeah.
And isn't that the game? We've got all of this mush and the swirlies. Sydney, what were we making?
So yeah, we did make a wonderful lunch with soy curls that are vegan, but we also have been making this vegetable broth. So there's this guy we really love called Massimo Bottura, and I love what he says about the vegetable broth, right? Because he's looking at all these scraps, these onion peels, carrot tops, and he's like, we could throw these away if we were blind.
Also, like, vegetables that are, like,
slightly going bad.
Yeah, on the edge.
Yeah.
And you don't really, you know.
Wilting cilantro, mushrooms,
like,
a little bit.
Okay.
Right.
Stop it and freeze it. And
bring
we'll
it
deal
back
with
to
it.
Life.
We'll deal with it in a minute.
So we've been roasting these on parchment paper in the oven so that we can make our own vegetable broth out of things that most people would throw away.
Isn't that the whole point
yeah.
of the alchemy? Let's start with alchemy. In the West, alchemy is the idea of turning lead into gold. And it has a lot to do with this idea of this kind of Greek philosophical concept that becomes really important in the Middle Ages, this idea of the great chain of being, so that the best metal is gold. What do you guys think the lowest level metal is?
Isn't it like platinum?
Well, platinum, that'd be up
silver?
On
the that should be pretty high.
The lowest of the low
the lowest.
Metals. Now, this is... Now,
and it's lower
understand.
Than bronze, so I'm,
the Dow
I'm trying
doesn't,
to figure out...
The Dow doesn't honor this hierarchy.
Yeah, yeah,
okay?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But in this Western
nickel
mindset...
Nickel or no. Copper?
The lowest of the low. Maybe you don't want this. I want gold, but I don't want necessarily to have this metal.
I mean, I know, like, obviously there's, like...
Plastic?
well, that's not a metal. Talking. But,
getting
you know,
close.
there's definitely, like, you know, gold, silver, and bronze. So it's got to be lower than all those.
Mm-hmm.
And nickel is in a lot of things. But even iron.
It's not, like,
is iron.
Titanium?
Cool. It's lead.
Lead.
So lead was... now, it's the heaviest. So lead was considered the closest to the center of the earth, which is where Satan's butt was. And then up in the heavens, you have gold, right? So there's the streets paved with gold, and then there's lead in the basement of Earth.
But wait, plumb line.
Yeah, but that the plumb line is based on using the lead, but see, the lead is drawing down. So if you think about this mystical tradition in the West, the idea is you're trying to let go of the physical things and get to the lofty things. So if you're considering metals, you want to consider the lofty, the upward metals, like gold, and not the lead, because the lead's drawing you down to the underworld.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Especially because, like, I don't know, I think that there is a confusion with, you know, whether we're dropped down into this earth or whether we are sprung up from out of this earth. And it's really weird that in a certain sense, we've been like trained to think that something that comes up out of the bottom of the earth is bad.
Yes. Yeah. So
or less than.
You're tapping into something good. So again, this is the Western. So when we think about alchemy in Western European context, alchemy was the art, essentially, of turning lead into gold. But go with me for a second on the rest of their worldview. Then you have plants. The lowest plant, who knows, some kind of weed. The highest of the plants, what do you think that is?
Like trees?
Before you get to trees, because there's trees
before
too.
Flowers?
Flowers. What flower?
Lotus?
No. That would be good. That's Eastern. We're talking the West.
Like sunflower.
Rose.
So the best metal is gold. The best flower is the rose.
I'm trying to think of Valentine's Day, right?
Like, so what's the best tree? So what's the best tree?
The best tree?
Western
Sequoia?
European.
I was going to say maple, but
it would be good.
Oak.
Yeah. So far we got the rose, we got the gold, we got the oak. What's the best animal?
The lowest level is the
earthworm. I don't want to be a worm.
It would probably be like a lion, right?
It is like a lion.
Yeah.
Gold, roses, oak trees, lions. What's the best mythical creature?
Unicorn.
The unicorn. Well, then what's above that? Human beings. What's the best human being? The highest human being.
Emperor?
Yeah. The king, the emperor. Yeah. Then above that are the angels, and the top angel is Michael the Archangel, and then at the top of that is God.
God.
So you go up this. So the idea, though, now go with me for a second. As much as that might be a note, see, you're sighing because it's unhelpful. It's been unhelpful.
I'm sad because, like,
it's
why,
very much based
why
on hierarchy.
The rose? Why the lion? Why, like,
aha,
you know,
okay,
like,
capitalism.
Why? Yeah, all these different things.
So stay with me for a second.
Diamond, they talk about, you know, but until there's a lot of diamonds you can find, like, for a rare.
This idea of hierarchy is part of the Western alchemy. So what you're trying to do, so you see this. People have said what the alchemists, the esoteric, you know, wizards of Western culture were trying to do. They were cool kids. They were cool, interesting people. But they were operating within this world of hierarchy. And when you're operating in the world of hierarchy, what do you think the point of learning how to turn lead into gold is, ultimately?
I guess.
So that you could make money?
So the first thing is, there were kings, there are stories of kings who would take people who claimed to be alchemists and they would imprison them and torture them to try to get them to make the lead turn into gold because they wanted the money. Okay, so at a very basic level, I think this is an interesting thing to think about because it says there is something behind religion and spirituality that's very powerful. And there's something behind alchemy that's very powerful. But if you take it too literally, you get ruined. If you take the idea of turning lead into gold literally and you turn it into money, the joke's on you, Buster. Mm-hmm. I believe that alchemy is something we should all consider for our lives. And the process of thinking about what alchemy means for us is the process of reorienting our values so that we don't think that the point of it is getting rich.
Yeah.
But
or,
whatever rich means, right? Turning lead into gold and hierarchy.
Or living forever. That's another piece.
Well, which takes us to the East. So now in the East, they were not necessarily, they were not operating under the same basic concepts that I just talked about. They're talking about something that's more related to mixing the kinds of important elements of the world under the Tao. And the concept is internal alchemy in Taoist tradition, in Chinese tradition, Naidan. And Naidan relates to the way that you can make use of the different elements of existence to prolong your life, just like you're saying. But it also is about physical, mental, and spiritual health, such that you could then survive death after you died. So the claim is, if you understand alchemy, by the way, both in the West and the East, if you can understand alchemy, you can learn how to die before you die, so you don't have to die when you die. Wait, that's the secret.
But how does that connect with the Fountain of Youth?
Well, the Fountain of Youth is both, like, it's profoundly true and literally a pitfall. So what happened was, there were all of these people in Chinese tradition that heard about this idea that you could have immortality through alchemy. And what they said is, great, let's get that. And so when you go back to the 4th century, you have this early idea of finding some substances. It could be cinnabar. You're going to create this elixir that's going to give you immortality, and it's going to be an actual potion. And by the 9th century, something like 5 emperors die from drinking the potion from the Taoist magicians.
That's crazy.
Oopsie daisy.
Crazy. Well, I will
five
say
five rulers die trying to have eternal life.
That is crazy.
Using the alchemy. So
it's also crazy, God but complexes. Also like in a weird sense, how do we ever learn what we're going to learn if certain people don't die? Trying.
Oh, well, yeah, we wouldn't know anything about medical stuff if we didn't.
But I will say that it's way better when you can, use, you know, subjects that maybe already passed or perhaps like already have something terminal. It is really, 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 really crazy to think, though, that some people care about living forever so badly that they're willing to risk their life over it.
Yeah.
And have, you know, it's one thing, like, if you already are dying, it's another thing if you're an emperor and, like, want to live forever.
Yeah.
And you're, like, going to try some of these things and you
lose. Because your ego is so big, you can never step down.
It's the exact, I mean, in a certain sense, now let's go with it this way. What did that emperor need to learn? Death.
Yeah.
The emperor thought he was going to live forever, and the only way he was going to live forever is to stop trying to grasp at whatever that is.
Yeah.
So
I do say that there is something amazing in my work with people that are dying, that they are so real at that moment. And especially like anybody that you're talking to that they know they're going to die, like there's no reason to sugarcoat anything. There's no reason to not have real conversations, and that authenticity is so refreshing, and it is so, I don't know, it's just
it
huge.
Is, yeah.
It's huge. And that's my favorite, absolute favorite piece about working with people that are dying. Cause there's nothing to hide. It's just nothing but you and the truth.
Well,
what else do you have?
Three chords in the truth. That's just a reference to. So.
Yeah. Similarly, I think even just being touched by death around you kind of eliminates your threshold for bullshit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah.
When you've seen some real things in life.
When Augie died, it changed our lives.
Yeah.
And all of that. Yes. Absolutely. 100%.
Now, so if you go to that question, though, I mean, this is something I think is, it's important to kind of understand the background and history of it is, so you get the Warring States period when this is kind of coming into play. And when you think about Taoism, we're interested in the Tao Te Ching, we're interested in Chuangzu, and this kind of Taoist understanding of how to exist in the world, very helpful, especially personally, politically. And what we're, I think, thinking is, if you're thinking for your own life about what alchemy means for you, these lessons that we've just scratched the surface on here for a second, the historical thing of people trying to have eternal life and dying, that's the puzzle that's for all of us to contemplate when we think about inner alchemy for our own lives. Are we are we trying to get some kind of supplement so that we don't age? Some kind of cream so we don't look old, some kind, you know, whatever it is to try to deny the reality of death, then that's not the real alchemy. That's exactly the wrong alchemy.
There's maybe two possibilities for that. One, you are trying to pause a moment of time in your life, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want, like, the next phase. Maybe perhaps that this is a sweet moment for you.
Sure, yeah.
Often, though, I think a lot of times people fear death and what's on the other side. And they're afraid to either admit or come to terms with the fact that they might die. It's the unknown.
People don't like having uncertainties in their life. They want to believe they know exactly what's going to happen. If you just do what you're supposed to do, everything's going to go according to this plan and your control.
And so that's the kind of the paradox of this. If we think about the main message when we contemplate this idea of the inner alchemist,
mm-hmm.
we're contemplating the way in which we need to take the stuff that we have in our lives and try to turn that, or in many ways, kind of let ourselves, this is the concept in Taoism, let ourselves become like a cauldron where these elements within us are mixed together and produce something beautiful. And that's the potion. Like, we are the potion.
Yeah.
But when we're trying to get the potion, whether, again, it's in the Western tradition or the Eastern traditions, that we're trying to use it to gain power, then we lose it all. Mm-hmm. So you have to die before you die. You have to use this to essentially kill ego. But then in a certain sense, when you think about all chemicals and water itself, it disintegrates. It kind of breaks down things and then brings them back to the one. Mm-hmm. So one of the main things about the Tao Te Ching is this idea that in a certain sense, everything is connected to the one. Everything splits out into the 10,000 things, but then gets kind of brought back into the one. And how do you get brought back into the one? Through the alchemy of the dissolving. So how do you become gold again? In a sense, you have to take it...
Or lead.
What's that?
Or lead.
Or lead. You got to go through the lead thing. I mean, this is actually very good. So we have to respect all of the elements to really understand it. But I think the main thing, though, is if we're thinking about this for our own lives, spiritual alchemy, inner alchemy, at the very basic level, is how can we find spiritual transformation? How can we find a way to take whatever we've got and turn that into the magic? Is it grief? Turn it into magic. Don't deny the grief. Just that's the substance that you've got. You could make other magic, but you don't have that. Like, you don't have that potion. So you got to make the different potion, because this is do we have turnips? Then we're going to make turnip magic. Sydney, we made garlic and pepper and onion skin magic, because that's what we had. But we turned it in from something that was trash into something that's going to be a really great broth. And last time you ladies made it, I used that. I took that broth. I put it into rice. When you're cooking rice, I put it into tamales. And all of a sudden, something that was just kind of bland, all of a sudden is incredibly, incredibly powerful. Stacey, to kind of put a cap on the main message of what this image or this concept of the inner alchemy is, what would you say we're finding for ourselves, or what do we want to think about for ourselves?
We will struggle in this entire process often until we don't struggle. And we're looking for other things outside of ourselves often to come to terms with some of this stuff. And I think that if we can come to peace within ourselves, then that ultimately is part of it. And the part where you said if you die before you die, you don't have to die. I think that, to me, is a huge piece of it. But I do think that sometimes there's outward substances that we turn to that will have different effects, and that
positive or negative,
right?
Right.
And And I do think that it's weird because sometimes like society has like sometimes acceptable and unacceptable ways to do this. And so I think sometimes we look when we're like trying to change up our body chemistry, sometimes we will look to outside sources for this, like, you know, you mentioned the Fountain of Youth or these various different things. And so where can we find peace? Where can we find a moment to rest or to be out of pain? Like,
right.
we suffer as human beings. Like, we are suffering a lot, like a lot of times. Like, it's not always suffering, but like when we are, then we look to other things. Like, what is it that will help us in some of that, right?
Yeah.
And so, and I think that there's wisdom to gain sometimes from other sources that will help us deal with our inner issues. And then like there's all sorts of effects. So if we can kind of go through a little bit sometimes of what has been used to sort of like either cope.
Actual chemical
or
substances.
Escape. Yes. Or, so, you know, like, at this point, like if it would be fun to kind of go through yeah. some of these things where maybe we find some rest, maybe we find escape, maybe we find some peace in some of these different things. And it would kind of be good to, I think, yeah. run through some of these things. Like, so Sid, do you have like something you want to mention?
So we were talking about earlier, right, what's considered acceptable in society
yeah.
to put into your body.
Capitalist society, especially.
Capitalist yeah. society. It's fine. You could have as much beer as you want, cigarettes as you want, have your cup of coffee every day. That's acceptable. That's fine.
So what do those things do for you?
They keep you going like a robot. They keep you able to go work and shut off your emotions. And then when you drink caffeine all day to keep yourself fueled along, and then you get home and you have your cigarette to relax and drink beer to forget about all your stress and yeah. attempt to wind down. That's acceptable,
and
but
sometimes
what's
necessary.
Not acceptable is psychedelics,
okay.
right? So if you're talking about the alchemy, like what elixirs are you putting in your body and how is that? It's interesting to me that these things that are going to harm you are seen as completely like as normal as vanilla ice cream. And then things that can potentially change people's lives and help them heal and literally give their brains new networks to grow around trauma are considered taboo or crazy.
Yeah, so share a little bit more about that.
I'm thinking about how one of the major ways that I was even able to come to terms on a practical, or not like a practical, but a logical, this is reality of what happened, was when I did mushrooms, you know, after Augie had died, and I watched the Terrence McKenna Tree of Life movie, and I actually laid on the ground and I died, and I went into the earth, and it basically told me that he's okay. This because I felt like I had went through it too.
Mm.
And so it gave me an understanding. And then I was reborn back out of the ground, and it helped me just become a little bit more okay with this traumatic reality. One of my best friends and I in high school, we did our AP Psych project on how MDMA was being used in therapy to get people that had emotional blockers up, able to let their walls down. And some of them were able to figure out how to actually deal with their trauma through feeling a sense of trust and like they could open up with their therapist easier. But yeah, I mean, there's been use of ketamine intravenously and
We met a woman at the death conversation we had over at the Kava place.
And she had tried everything.
She was not some kind of like hooligan.
No, yeah, she was grieving and she had tried pretty much every antidepressant there was to try. She had tried lots of things and nothing helped her. And it wasn't until this that she kind of felt like she got some insights out of that that were healing and helpful to her. So it's interesting that, and that's kind of changing now too. It's psychedelics are becoming less and less taboo.
We're here in Portland, and within the year, they're going to have psychedelic therapy for people dealing with severe depression, terminal illness, you know, kind of drawing from all this long research. It was interesting. I remember when I started getting interested in this, we had Paul Stamets out to the college. Mm-hmm. And if I would have known now how, like, famous he is now amongst the, you know, the community. I mean, he was like, we thought he was super cool. He came out, we had the Snohomish Mycological Society mm-hmm. jointly sponsoring this event. And he came out and he did his pitch on how mushrooms can change the world. He didn't talk about psychedelics there, but in, you know, kind of following him and seeing other things, you know, then we joined, you know, we joined this Mycological Society going to find mushrooms just to try to understand the scene. Never ran into maybe 300 to 400 identifications. I don't know if I'm overestimating it. Sometimes I confuse it with the bird list. But we saw so much fungus, you know, as we would hike. And it was really great up in Washington. So many different wonderful mushrooms, edible, interesting, colorful. But we never saw any magic mushrooms.
Right.
The only times I've seen magic mushrooms, one, I was taking church kids down in Costa Rica to do whatever we were doing. We were hiking through Costa Rica. I had Augie on my back, and we came across just this field of these mushrooms. I said, well, Augie, how old was Augie at the time? Third grade? I said, hey there, kid.
Second grade.
Those are some magic mushrooms. Maybe we're not going to touch grade. Them. But like normally, that would be interesting to just kind of figure out, what do you see there? And then the second time, we were in France, and we were at the Lascaux Caves exhibit there, and they were discussing, like, what's going on? Why is it that these caves have these horses, but they don't eat the horses? Yeah. And I was suggesting that maybe the horses, just kind of like in Hinduism, where you have the sacred cow, maybe there's something about the fact that the poop that the cows and the horses have poop that grows mushrooms.
And there was more than just horses in the cave drawings, as far as
yes, but no. The question that the guy said was, why is it that they have all these horses but they don't eat the horses?
Yeah.
Why are the horses so important to them? And I said, maybe it's because of the mushrooms that come out of their butts.
Yeah,
you know.
Poop.
And he says, oh, I don't know. Like, it's. I mean, it makes sense, right? Like, look, I come in there. Am I the guy who's going to kind of come on some fringe interpretation? But I really believe that it is suggestive to me that they are in this cave creating this kind of psychedelic art, and they are like mesmerized by the movements of these painted horses on the wall, and they don't eat the horses. Just like in India, you're not eating the cow, but there's something sacred about it. I believe that there seems to me, at least,
if you're surrounding by the poops. And so you're saying, nearby this cave,
we went outside, and there was one of the original horses.
There were magic mushrooms
growing right out of the poop. So the point being, I've seen these things twice. I was on the hunt for them in this other context. But what was the kind of the real difference is people knowing their environment. If you're hanging out near these caves, and there's some these little fruits that are growing up out of the poops, some sucker is gonna try it. If nothing else, it's going to happen on a dare.
Well,
so if they're growing up in that region.
You already mentioned that several emperors died.
The emperor is trying to manage his existence. He's trying to live forever. He's trying to have power, and he ends up dying. Then somebody else says, hey, I dare you to, hey, you know, Ooglug, I dare you to eat that weird fungus growing out of poop. And the guy does, and he meets God.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's, so they're going back to this dude named Wasson. There's this concept that that religion seems to come out of the kind of experience that you get through psychedelics like mushrooms. Now, locally in Portland, the dude who hosts the very cool Monday open mic night, Tom Hatzis, he is a researcher. He's written a lot on this stuff. And what I really like about his take on some of this is, now that you're allowed to talk about it, it's good to use the data that exists and be a real researcher. What he basically is saying is, if you look at the research, there are a variety of very direct bits of evidence that people are using poppy seeds. They're using, you know, the opium poppy. They're using cannabis oil. And there's a variety of other things that they're putting into concoctions. Even when they're talking about wine, there's something else that they might be putting in the wine. But it's not always the psilocybin mushroom. There have been people that have made these wild claims, like that Jesus was a mushroom, that Christianity was really just actually about worshiping the magic mushroom. It's fanciful. It's also historically not factual. So what I told him is, whether we agree or disagree on other things, I was really kind of happy to hear that there's a broader conversation about the history of religion as it relates to this kind of plant medicine conversation that isn't wacky, right? So like growing up or in the academic world, whether it's because of Christianity or because of the academy not wanting to touch wingnuts that are into psychedelics, they're not often willing to have a real conversation about the what seems to me almost obvious reality that many of the world's spiritual and religious traditions arise out of a shamanism that uses psychedelics. Because if you go around the world, anthropologists meet people and they're doing different plant medicines to get into a spiritual state to have this transformation. So that then takes us back to where we were kind of headed, which was, why is it if in capitalism you got nicotine, weed, nicotine
weed
and coffee.
Definitely not
changing these days.
Nicotine, coffee. It is changing a little bit. I mean, in a certain sense, I think the extent to which it's normalized, that is something to kind of consider. I think in the 60s, it would have been unthinkable to think that there would be people that would get back from their cubicle jobs, blaze up, play
right.
video games, and
now
go back to their cubicle jobs.
There's a certain side to the legalism where the dispensaries and all that just being everywhere is kind of making it normalized like bar culture, mm-hmm. whereas like a lot of old school growers and stuff were a little bit upset by that because it changes the mood. But anyways,
I'm glad that I'm not like worried about the legality of it, but it makes me sad
right.
that it's
it makes it
bougie,
corporatized.
It is interesting that I feel like when the war on drugs happened, it basically like told the kids like, oh, all drugs are bad, right?
Unless we prescribe them to you.
They were prescribing meth. They were saying that weed was going to make you go crazy.
The war on drugs, like, basically then, like, went to anything drug-related. And they lumped it all in on the same
thing.
Well,
they legally did, yeah. So, like,
which is just dangerous. It's, you know, false information that could have real consequences.
Cause well, and it's weird because even with weed or marijuana, like literally the meme often is that you're going to stop on a green light. Like when you're on, if you are driving,
the meme is drunk drivers drive through a red light. People on cannabis stop at a stop sign and wait till the stop sign turns green. That's the
And so I guess it is strange that I mean, of course, the war on drugs, like if you were going to talk about alcohol, then yes, but it wasn't just alcohol. And they left alcohol kind of out of it and said like, don't drunk drive. But then like the war,
they're actually kind of proud of you if you're doing booze,
but the war on drugs became all about like no weed, nothing, like
right.
like all of it is bad, and they never like differentiated between any of the different types.
It's just interesting like that alcohol has kind of always been acceptable. Like, yeah, they're saying don't drunk drive, but alcohol is just shutting off your
all your inhibitions.
Inhibition versus like other drugs make you creative. They make you think. They make you realize things. They might get you to look around and be like, hey, the way this whole government system is going, what's up with
that? Oh, they don't want that. They don't want that at all.
But if you just go home and get drunk every day, you're not thinking about that.
Yeah. It helps you. Acceptable. Yeah, no, it helps you to deal with the tyranny. You're just like, all right, well, I got this. Mm-hmm. So that I think that is a main take. That's a big takeaway from this question of the inner alchemist is what is it that I'm bringing into my life? And the inner alchemist then also reminds us, and this is what I'm suggesting to you, dear listener, if you are finding yourself addicted to caffeine, I'm not saying what you should do or shouldn't do, but what if you swap that out for something like kava? Or something like something else that I'm not, you know, I mean, what is it that you're, what's the potion that you're using? Because if you want to, you could play the game where you're saying, I'm going to play no medicine. I'm using no potion. But if you're going to use no potion, then fine. Then use meditation and walking and jogging. Then do that. But if you say, I'm not going to do drugs, but you're doing all these other drugs, are you taking the man's drugs? Like, what are you doing?
So I know we were blessed with being able to like be introduced to pulque, but can we explain to listeners a little bit more about like pulque? Yes. And what that is?
So pulque, it's an alcoholic beverage made from the fermented sap of the maguey plant. It's traditional in central Mexico. It's a color of milk. It has this sour yeast-like taste. There's no carbonation. So it's kind of like tastes like a version of a flat kombucha, which it's hard to explain, but it's good.
In the best way. I think that's a great way to, if you like kombucha, then that's the best way.
There's a sweetness to it.
Yeah.
And so they used to use it, the ancient Mesoamericans used it for religious rituals. The idea of it was a very big deal, like a spiritual gift that we received this.
Yeah.
It's not something that you would just drink on a Saturday afternoon. It's a ceremonial thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even like Augie loved it, but I don't even, he maybe only had it like a few days. It's really hard to find.
And he never had it.
I don't even know that he for sure tried it.
I don't think he had it.
But he knew the history of it.
He knew the history of it, but mainly Mezcal was his favorite.
Can you share a little bit more about Mezcal and like.
Yeah, so I actually, when I worked at Puesto, which was the bar that Augie worked for, we got to do a paid tasting. And so anybody who makes mezcal is called a mezcalero. And they had this elderly man and his granddaughter come in from Oaxaca. And we got to do a paid tasting with them. And I'll never forget what he said to me before we all tried it. He says, first, open your mind and your heart and your soul to receive the mezcal. And then you like mentally prepare yourself to accept the love, and then you have the sip. And that's kind of when I realized and fell in love with for the first time like what Augie was talking about.
Yeah.
The mezcal here, it has a different magic, this type of spirit, and that was his favorite spirit to play around with. He loved doing like a spicy mezcal margarita, or he would always come up with these custom things with mezcal. He used passion fruit cordials, and he got really into just the crafting of it. And that's, I mean, if you're gonna drink like Augie is what I would say. You know, every cocktail was like a painting. You know, you can just go home, buy the capitalist beer, turn on the TV, finish your capitalist day, or you can sit there and create some art, right? He would boil down a ginger tamarind syrup for 2 hours. He would infuse the habaneros in the tequila or in the mezcal. And everything, every little detail of it, he put thought into. The garnish.
Mm.
It was an aesthetic choice for each part of the cocktail. And that, you know, that was his art. That was his passion. And so I try to embody that because, you know, I definitely drink, but I would rather drink with gusto or artfully, right? Like create something that's mm-hmm. beautiful that reminds me of him versus go like, you know, buy a 40. There's a time and a place for that too.
And there's a time and a place for it. I mean, isn't that part of it? Yeah.
Yeah. But, and it's like, there's a time and a place for everything. Right. But that's the philosophy I liked that what Augie thought about.
Yeah.
About
like all of these elixirs, all of these different chemicals that we can put inside of ourselves, they serve different purposes. And like,
yeah.
Are we trying to be more present? Are we trying to escape? Are we trying to prolong life? Are we trying to numb this existence?
Yeah. I'm 100% with us on this question of escape or not escape, right? But I think it caused me to go back to look up Proverbs 31.
That's funny.
Yeah, from the Bible, because I think it's a really interesting one. This is probably the only chapter in the Bible written by a woman. At least explicitly.
I didn't know they allowed that.
They didn't. This is the mom. This is the mom of this dude named King Lemuel. Okay. And it says this, as she writes, it is not for kings. This is chapter 31, last chapter of the Proverbs, verse 4. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for rulers to crave beer. Lest they drink and forget what the law decrees and deprive all the oppressed of their rights. Give beer to those who are perishing, wine to those who are in anguish. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more.
Wow.
Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of those who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and the needy. In other words, hey, Kavanaugh.
You're sad.
You drunken Kavanaugh. Well, he's sad, right? But like you're drinking and you're being an abuser. You're drinking and you're miscarrying justice.
Okay.
Meanwhile, I think the application is you're putting people in jail for doing certain kinds of drugs that just keep them able to cope with the capitalist.
That's where I said you're sad.
Right.
Not Kavanaugh. I didn't expect you to say Kavanaugh.
No, what I'm saying is, so Kavanaugh was like, he's like, hey, he's one of the bros. And everyone's like, well, you know, boys will be boys. They drink. They get a little out of hand. Right.
Yeah, that's right. Not acceptable.
Right. And so the point is that there is this sense in which this is what's interesting about the Bible. If you read the Bible, not as as a manual that just dropped down from heaven, but as very interesting reflection on when you should drink and when you shouldn't drink and who should drink. People that are in charge of flying planes, maybe, you know, slow it down there, pal.
Yeah.
Me sleeping in the 35th row of the plane, give me an extra cocktail. And the fact that we're trying to police the poor and the downtrodden, it just occurs to me that sometimes escape is what you need. Sometimes escape is what you need. So the idea that there is one size fits all for whatever the magic is, whatever the chemicals are, I think that I am so glad that cannabis has been legalized. And I believe especially that being able to use CBD for your aches and pains is...
Grandma's like back pain. She's, you know, crying because she's in back pain. Oh. And now she feels like her muscles are relaxed. That's
so
fantastic.
Good. But then that doesn't lead me to ignore the fact that you could just kind of check out of life and just get stoned all day. So like as a very much anti-drug war dude, I recognize that you can just misuse even the best of plants.
Like, you know, we've needed to deal with certain things. We've had a lot of things going on, but like a lot of the health professionals, you know, you're not going to get like Xanax for your panic attacks.
If there was ever a time when Mr. Jeff needed a Xanax, it was the last year and a half.
Yeah.
They gave me no Xanax.
And maybe
because people misuse the Xanax, but I should have had the Xanax.
Maybe we could try harder, but I will say that they are willing hand over fist to give us
certain drugs,
antidepressants,
certain ones they push,
and maybe sleeping pills. Please take those pills if you need them. But why is it that we live in a society that it's completely acceptable to keep handing that stuff out?
Right.
and then they're like super dead against anything else, and that we then need to also maybe use like those kind of maybe prescribed pills, and then maybe you use like weed if you're lucky in some areas, but coffee and booze for the most part is the rest of it. Like, why? Why is it in our society that we are also like having to like look to all these other outside substances to just feel like we're okay?
Because they're crushing us.
Yeah.
I guess I would have to say that there's got to be another way that's possible, another dream of another universe where we don't need to use all of these different alchemies just to survive.
There is a need for us to manage the medicines, the potions that we've got in our lives, and they could be metaphorical, they could be literal. What are we putting into our bodies? These are things that it's not as simple as saying, this stuff's good, this stuff's bad. This might be good or bad for you. And I think we're running out of time, so I don't want to get into one big point that we could make, I think, quite briefly, and that is, I used to think that you could just give the medicine to everybody and everybody be healed. And that doesn't seem to be the case. Some people just can't process looking in the mirror. So, like, even the best of medicines in the wrong context is not going to work. So if you're like, hey, that's cool, I'm going to, you know, explore different kinds of, you know, chemistry for myself. Maybe you've got to take it slow. I keep coming back to this problem where many people within religious contexts forget to take a lot of this symbolically. So if you take alchemy too literally, it will literally kill you if you're an emperor of China in the Tang Dynasty. It will literally kill at least 5 emperors in China because they took it too literally. It literally killed Western alchemists to say that they could change lead into gold, and then they were tortured and killed because they were not able to actually change lead into gold. In our own personal lives, if we take Sunday school too seriously, it'll kill ourselves and our family. And I don't mean to be flippant about it, but I think it's the same thing. I think that there's something powerful about religion that you want to draw from. It can be useful for you. It can help you process life. But if you're not careful and you don't realize the game that's being played or the language that you're working through, and you take it literally, it will literally kill you. And I think of all those things, that's important. And I think this is important for us as we reflect on coming out of religious traditions where they not only took this stuff literally, but they were very emphatic about systematizing it and making the subscription to those ideas the determining factor about whether you were in a good or bad spot spiritually. And I think that has taken us so far afield from the original shamanic roots of religion that it's just time for reset.
So when we talk about that you have to die before you die so you don't have to die, I think that for me, if you're looking for the fountain of youth, if you're looking for how you yourself will negate ever like having to die, I think I think that's not possible. I think that your ego always has to come
to a dead end.
I very much enjoy all the opportunities that I have as Stacy here on this earth with the human beings that I'm here with. So
and when you're done being Stacy,
then I'm experiencing all of the universe, and it is so much bigger than me.
You're nothing and everything at once. So
I'm afraid of a lot of things. Yeah. Death isn't really one of them. I'm like, that's okay. I'm good. Yeah.
But isn't that the irony? I think what I'm hearing you say is the only way to actually have immortality, the only way to have that elixir of life, is to let go of
me. Let go of Stacy.
But then you get it back and then some, right?
And then some.
So that takes... Yeah.
just to, because it reminds me of exactly what Mom is saying, one of my favorite bands, the Growlers, they have this song called Die and Live Forever. It's basically everything Stacey just said.
Would you read some of those lyrics then?
Yeah, sure. It says, it's not about the little things, not about blood. Wipe your heart off, make room for love. Love together, suffer together, laugh and cry together. Live and die, remember. Die and live forever. It's not about the little things. I know they add up, but they can never be worth more than love. And then it repeats, but that's also really interesting to me too, because if you're concerned about your ego, if you're concerned about appearances, if you're concerned about the small, meaningless shit that doesn't matter, right? It's like, it's a very like, kill your ego, and this is what really matters, like the people you love.
Die and live forever. Another way of saying
peace upon peace. Thank you so much, friends, for joining us for this episode of the Protect Your Noggin podcast. You want to join in on the conversation? We'd love to respond to your questions or comments on a future show. You can record a message by going to protectyournoggin.org and clicking on the blue voice message button. And don't worry about getting it perfect, since you'll have 5 minutes and a chance to preview your message before sending. You can also send an email if you're not comfortable with leaving a voice message. Please also follow us on Twitter at @thePYNP. And rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you found this show of any help, why not share it with a friend? Until next time, peace upon peace, friends.
But he said there wasn't any leather. He said I was going out of my mind.
Not going out of your mind. You're slowly and systematically being driven out of your mind.
Why?
That's because you found this letter in love too much.